Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Two guests this week. The first is Paula Levine. She is an investigative reporter for ESPN and one of the best sports investigative reporters in the country. We discuss her reporting on Michigan State and Baylor and sexual assault in colleges in relation to college athletics. I think you're going to find it really interesting. Paula gives basically how these stories come about and how much resources are extended when it comes to doing these stories as a place like ESPN does. We finish up with Peter King, my longtime Sports Illustrated colleague, and he'll talk about his podcast and how he books the guests he does, what he likes in an NFL guest, and just some other just general podcast talk about why we both like this medium for sports. So Paula Levine and Peter King coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Okay, and we bring in Paula Levine, who, as I said at the top, joined ESPN in 2008 as an investigative reporter, and she is absolutely one of the best in the craft. Paula, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right, Paula, here's the first graph of a recent piece you co-wrote on Michigan State University. Michigan State University administrators have long claimed to the federal government and public that they have handled sexual assault, violence, and gender discrimination complaints properly. But an outside-the-lines investigation has found a pattern of widespread denial, inaction, and information suppression of such allegations by officials ranging from campus police to the Spartan Athletic Department. I think a lot of people who will listen to this podcast will be familiar with your recent piece, or pieces, I should say, on Michigan State. They obviously involve the athletic department, and they involved two of the most well-known college coaches in this country. So I want to start from a little bit sort of from the beginning. What did you find in your reporting on Michigan State, and how long did it take you to find it?
Well, the answer to the first question is we found a number of cases involving football and basketball players that had never reached the light of day, had never been reported. And we found a lot of questions in those cases as to how they were handled by the university and if there was any discipline or even any discussion with the players over what had happened. And then we also came across what I would call our whistleblower, which is a former Michigan State sexual assault counselor, Lauren Allswede, who provided even more documents about how the university handled a particular case and implications in there that it was not handled properly and that the young woman and her parents were quite disappointed with what was described as a real lack of inaction. And couple that with years of suppressing information and withholding documents, that kind of goes to your second question, which is how we got this started, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think and again, you can go as long as you want on this podcast. There are no short answers. One of the things I think the public really values is when reporters are transparent about like where the process starts and how the process starts. So I know that ESPN back in 2014 was doing reporting on multiple universities. You were requesting copies of police reports right, involving football and basketball players. So I'm not sure if that's where the story originated, but I do know that the investigative unit at ESPN has been reporting on this kind of stuff for a while.
That is where the story originates. So it's important. It's important to understand how that's part of this because it's unusual. So in the fall of 2014, we had an objective of seeing whether student athletes received preferential treatment from the criminal justice system. And so as part of that, we chose 10 schools across the country, representative of the different Power Five conferences, and we requested police reports from the campus police and the city police over the past six seasons with all the student athlete names. And in Michigan State's case, the East Lansing Police Department responded right away, gave us pretty much everything we'd asked for, hardly redacted anything. Actually, of all of the departments we dealt with in the entire project, were the perhaps quickest to respond. Michigan State took several weeks, I think even into months, charged us thousands of dollars. And when we finally got the first set of documents back, we noticed something right away, which was all of the names are redacted. Like, there were no names on these reports anywhere. And that made it pretty much, we couldn't do the reporting we wanted to do, because for that story, we had to have the names, because then we had to check the courts to see if there was a court action filed, or if the player was disciplined, if we saw a lack of playing time that season, right? So with that, and then you also just couldn't verify the documents that was actually the student athlete, right? So we went back and forth with them, tried to make our case, and that failed. And so ESPN ended up suing Michigan State. And this was in early 2015. Hmm. And we ended up prevailing initially, and the school appealed, and we prevailed again. And the school appealed again. And at this point, we're up to the Supreme Court of the state of Michigan. And we're also into December of 2015. The decision ended in our favor, and the judges actually ended up ordering the school to hand over the records and disclose the names and some other issues of redaction. So by this time, the original story we were working on had already aired, had already posted in, I think it was June of 2015. And we just had to go with the data we have from East Lansing for Michigan State. And we noted that in the piece. We noted in the piece that what was going on with Michigan State. So we get these records finally, because, we don't get them in December. We get them like a few months later, and we start going through them. And we start coming across some of these cases that are disturbing, and we look into them. But then the one thing that is a problem is anytime you deal with litigation, you're going for several months. And so before we feel like we're ready to report something, we need to go back and then get the records from the time that's elapsed. So we have to go back and request, okay, everything from the time of our original request, which is fall of 2014, to present. So we have to wait on that, and then we have issues over that. And in the midst of all this, so we're spending a lot of time just waiting on records. In the midst of all this, obviously, we're doing a lot of other stories. One of them for me was, and my colleague Mark Schleba, was Baylor. So right. In between all of this, we did the reporting on Baylor. We wrote the book on the violated on Baylor, all of this in the middle of all this stuff, because we're still waiting on stuff And so we're, kind of gathering string on Michigan State and come back to it. And one of the case, we end up getting connected with the Carolyn Shaner, who was the woman who reported that the two basketball players, Keith Appling and Adrian Payne, had sexually assaulted her. And we get connected with her sexual assault counselor, who is Lauren Allswede, the one who was in our story. And then as things go, like, one thing leads to another. And so we look into one thing, we find the Travis Walton stuff. We come, the former player, Travis Walton, who was alleged to have been involved in the sexual assault in April 2010. We look into his background, and we come across another incident and so forth. And so we're actually, I think the last records request we had to Michigan State wasn't completely fulfilled until the beginning of January 2018. Mm-hmm. In the fall of 2017, when my colleague John Barr is working on the Nassar case, we start having discussions about, okay, is this something that we should look at together? I mean, they're kind of focused on the Michigan State part of Nassar. And at that point, like, the volume had started to come up on Michigan State's inaction in that Nassar case. And now here we have, somewhat similar pattern of behavior from the university about suppressing information and so forth. And so that was sort of when we decided, let's pursue these two stories together, because they're both dealing with Michigan State and similar but different issues, right? And then we were still sort of juggling how we were going to do this until stuff really sort of came to a head last week. And we went to the spokesman, Michigan State spokesman, on Wednesday with the key points in our findings, right? And then it was 2 days later, less than 48 hours later that the athletic director, Mark Hollis, resigns. Mm. And so then we push our, that's what prompted us to push our story out, on Friday. And so that's kind of how we got there. But I will say one thing that's important is that going back, even back to the first production of the record, so back to 2016, we had started to ask Michigan State to talk to us. We wanted to have someone sit down on camera, or even not on camera, just have an on-the-record conversation with us about some of the stuff we were finding. And we had requested interviews with the coaches, and every single time we went to them, we were denied.
Hmm. I want to ask you a couple things off what you just said, and I appreciate that explanation. And I think it'll be important for listeners to know what happens with an experienced investigative reporter like yourself. How often do universities use delay tactics when you are trying to obtain public records? And interesting to me, what stands out there is once you guys get redacted files back, that probably keys off something in reporters like you that why is so much of this documentation redacted?
Oh, absolutely. I mean that's just human nature of any investigative reporter, right? I mean, the harder some person or some agency pushes against you for getting information, the more you think, all right, why are you pushing so hard to not release this? Clearly, there must be something in there that's worth reporting. As to the first part of your question, do I come across this? Oh my God, all the time. I mean, and it's not the first time we've been involved in litigation with a school either. It's incredibly common. It is incredibly common for universities to delay to either, charge. I'll tell you, like within the last month, I made a records request on something this fall. And, like a few weeks ago, I got a notice back from the school and, they wanted $10,000 for my records request. And I'm like, I don't even know what to say to that.
$10,000 to do like the photocopying, like what's the justification?
$10,000 to do the search of their, I think it was something related to email correspondence, to do the search of their, data and then have the attorneys review the records and hand them over. And here's the funny thing about all this. This is what kills me, because that's why I brought up the whole East Lansing Police Department comparison. Like I'd made a similar request to a different school, which didn't charge us anything at all, and turned over the records and like we were good to go. It's amazing to me because we do a lot of these things where we try to see if there's a trend or if there's, you know, if there's a pat, whatever. You know, we oftentimes will make the same, especially when it comes to college sports, we'll oftentimes make the same request of multiple universities. And it is mind-boggling the difference in responses you get. In terms of how long it takes them, in terms of how much work they say it's going to take, and then in terms of how much they want to charge you for it. Hmm. It's kind of ridiculous.
One of the questions that came up when I put out that you were going to be a guest on this podcast was about what happens when it's a private school. So you and your colleague at ESPN, obviously you did, co-wrote a book, Violated, Exposing Rape at Baylor University Amid College Football Sexual Assault Crisis. That's with Mark Schlabaugh, you co-wrote that book. So Baylor's a private school, not necessarily subject to the same open record requirements as public schools. So how difficult is it to acquire documents at a private school versus a private school like Baylor versus a public school like Michigan State?
Well, I'll take that in two parts, right? The first part is when you're talking about police records. So something wonderful happened for us with Baylor, which is shortly before this whole thing broke with Baylor, the Texas legislature had changed the law in the state of Texas to say that police departments at private universities are subject to open records law, because the Baylor Police Department has all the same powers as the city police department. They can arrest people, they can ask for search warrants, they can forward charges to the county prosecutor. They're not just campus safety volunteer, criminal justice majors. I mean, they're cops. They're real cops. And so as such, the state, I guess, right and rightfully so, recognized that they should be also subject to the same level of transparency as a city law enforcement agency would. So that was even with that, though, we got a lot of pushback from the Baylor Police Department that we ended up having to go to the Attorney General's office and so forth. But at least, you know, there was some of that. And we had made that argument when we were trying to get records out of Notre Dame as well as part of that story that I referenced earlier. And we actually ended up in court with them. And unfortunately, in that case, even though the situation was the same, the campus police department had the same powers as any other department in the state of Indiana. We lost, and it was very unfortunate. So that's the police records are one thing. So when you go beyond that, then it's completely different. Like there's no obligation on the behalf of Baylor to respond to a public records request outside of its campus police. Whereas with Michigan State University, they are subject to the state open records law. And so there is an obligation for them to respond. Even within that, they have a lot of exemptions that they try to rely on to withhold or deny information. But, you know, I think with the private schools, it just makes sourcing that much more important. I mean, if you can get people to leak information to you, you know, if you can get information out of others in the community, the whole former employee thing is key. And that was one of one of our best sources was someone who had used to work at Baylor, who had been former President Ken Starr's chief of staff, and we tracked her down at her current job. So, it's a different, I mean, there's different ways to get financial records out of private schools, because they don't have to turn over the same stuff as public schools. There's ways around some of that, but yeah, it's a very different challenge.
There's a lot of people in the media I know who listen to this podcast, and a lot of younger media people. And I think it'd be really valuable if you could talk about just what your approach is to FOIA requests and getting public records, and just even for those laymen who are not in the media listening to this podcast, and obviously there are people who do. Can you give a Cliff Notes version of how it works, how a reporter goes about attempting to gain those documents?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do entire workshops on that, so I'll try to condense that. So the first thing I always tell people is, know what the law is. And that's really important, because every state is different. If you had success getting mugshots in one state, don't assume you're going to get them in another state, because state laws vary wildly on these different issues. So do a little research into what the law is. And then the second thing is, try to be, this is, you got to hit the sweet spot with this, right? So you want to be, as narrowly focused as you can to increase the odds that you'll get a prompt response, but you also don't want to be too narrowly focused to where you miss information that would make a good story. And this is a lot of times when people want to request email correspondence and stuff like that. And then the third thing is, always be aware that when you make a records request, you have to ask for records. You can't just ask for information. I see this mistake made a lot. People say, well, tell me, they'll send a records request and they'll say, tell me how many sexual assault cases you've had against, student athletes. And the school's like, well, that's not a records request. And so you always got to be aware of, you have to ask for the record. So I'm requesting records of this particular document with this particular thing over this particular period of time. And that greatly increases your odds. And the last thing I would say is, before you send an email, pick up the phone. Pick up the phone and call the person you're sending it to and say, hey, I'm looking for this information. Are you the right person to get it? Can you help me just so that we're on the same page here? And I mean, as much as I think, I don't always do, if I'm like asking for something like super simple, I don't do that. But if you're trying to get into like a more complicated request don't start off as this being a fight. I mean, start off with as this being a conversation and try to work with someone before it gets to the level of where you're getting into an argument.
That's really good advice and really interesting. Something that I wanted to ask you, and again, this my guess is that this is going to happen at levels above you, your own specific bosses at Outside the Lines and the news and information gathering unit. But what kind of communication happens between those working on an investigative piece or their bosses and the programming side of ESPN, which has relationship with conferences, financial relationships many times, which has relationships with coaches? Do you let your own colleagues, do you give them a heads up that you're not going to give the content away, of course, but do you give them a heads up that we're investigating this and this may create some kind of dilemmas for you if you are doing some kind of negotiating and or interacting with conference officials, you know, on a story like this? Obviously, this is not a good story for the Big Ten and certainly not a good story for Michigan State. I wonder, does the journalism side ever at least give the heads up to the programming business side that this could be coming down the pike?
I'm not involved in those conversations. I think a lot of this is on a case-by-case basis. But, I mean, I will tell you, in all honesty, I have no idea what the conversations were around this story. I don't.
Okay.
And I think, to some degree, they purposefully keep me out of that.
Yeah, I think that's smart. Have you always found – have you, in the course of your investigative reporting at ESPN, have you ever sort of come across any kind of church and state issues, or have they, generally speaking, left you alone to do what you do?
They have left me alone. I will tell you that in all honesty. I have never been told, you can't do this, you can't pursue this. No, I haven't. I mean, and I'm glad of that, because I know it's a huge concern, right? I mean, you just pointed out all the reasons why it is.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's good. I think at your level, the hope is that you never hear from them, whether your bosses do. Obviously, that's a different question and a question for them. I want to get into some of the specifics about what you reported, because obviously this became a national story. This is from your piece saying that since Mark D'Antonio's tenure began in 2007 as Michigan State's head football coach, at least 16 MSU football players have been accused of sexual assault or violence against women, according to interviews and public records obtained by Outside the Lines. Mark D'Antoni, since then, has come out and saying, denying or claiming that any allegations that his program mishandled sexual assault are completely false. I know you have seen that. Before we get to Izzo, we'll start on D'Antoni. What is your response to the Michigan State football coach being very active in saying that the allegations that have been brought from the Outside the Lines piece are completely false?
What he said in one of his statements was that he had not individually handled a case of sexual assault. And we say in our piece that he, according to our source, he had a role in handling one of them. We don't know to what extent his involvement was. I mean, clearly someone else knew about this, I mean, because it was told to this woman by a different university administrator. I would like to know. I mean, that was one of the questions we had all going a way back, was, you know, when these things have come to you, what have you done? The one other thing that was somewhat confusing to us, which is the point that we really were trying to make in that, was that he said last June, when addressing the four football players who had gotten in trouble in 2017.
Right.
A reporter asked him, how have you handled cases like this before? And he says, well, this is new ground for us. This hasn't happened previously. And, we point out all these cases that we found, you know, how do you reconcile that? And someone asked him at the press conference, well, did you know about those other unreported cases? And he says they came to me from the authorities. So I guess the question is, well, when did they come to you from the authorities? And if that's the case, you know, does that contradict you saying last year this was the first time they've had to deal with this?
That would be
the question that I have.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there. And I imagine the answer is yes, but has Outside the Line specifically asked to talk to him one on one? And has what has been?
Oh,
what
yes, is, yes,
multiple
yes,
times.
No,
and what?
Yes, no.
I was going to say, and what has his response been to those requests, or Michigan State's response?
No. I mean, we asked months ago, I believe, and then right before the report came out. So I had shared with the university spokesman on Wednesday all of the, in that part too, that exact line about the former sexual assault counselor saying that she had been told that he had this player talk to his mom. I relayed all that. And then I said in the conversation, I said, I want to be absolutely sure that Coach D'Antonio and Coach Izzo are aware of what we're going to report and that they have an opportunity to respond. And I told him, I said, I'm going to reach out directly to the sports information directors for each of those coaches and send them a separate email. And he's like, that's fine. And I sent those two emails and I did not get a response. But Wednesday was not the first time that we had asked to talk to the two coaches.
Okay, that's important. I want to move on to Izzo because, and again, there's a little bit of a perception game here, but I think the general public, if they're going to be surprised, are going to be maybe more surprised at Tom Izzo because he has a reputation of historically being someone who's open to the press. You know, again, reputationally, someone who is an honest broker, reputationally, someone who's, and I realize this is sort of cliche, but, you know, one of the good guys in college basketball. And so, and somebody who's been, you know, very involved with the media, including at times sort of being a guest analyst at places, including ESPN. So that's sort of the backdrop of this when you're reporting, comes out about mishandling allegations and things and allegations that have come to the forefront that that were not previously reported. So that's a little bit of the background. So first off, you've seen some of Tom Izzo's responses publicly to this report, including to your reporter, I think I'm pronouncing your name right, Tisha Thompson, who,
yes.
I mean, that was really smart and aggressive reporting that she had in a open press conference. And I'm, again, this is my judgment here, my evaluation, where Tom Izzo did not provide answers. He, in my opinion, provided just more questions with lack of answers. So first and foremost, Paula, how many times did you attempt to get Tom Izzo to respond to your reporting? And what was your evaluation of his public responses so far to your reporting and Tisha Thompson's questions?
Again, we had requested to talk to him a while ago, last year. And then when I sent those emails that I mentioned earlier, like I sent them to the sports information director for basketball and for football. So those were all done at the same time. And in terms of his response, I mean, it's not unexpected. I mean, he's saying he's going to cooperate with the investigation. He's not going to comment. We see this a lot. I feel like he should be answering. I don't know what he was told to say or to not say. The one thing that was interesting is he says, I think she asked him, why Travis Walton left in 2015, and Coach Izzo seemed to be taken aback by that question.
Right.
That he wasn't sure why he left, and people have come out after that and questioned how did he not know that, because for a while in 2010, at the beginning of the year, Travis Walton was actually living in Coach Izzo's, or staying at least for a while, in his basement.
Right.
I don't believe he was staying in his basement at the end of the semester, but clearly the two were very close, which is what I'm trying to say. And so I think people wonder, like, how would you not? You know, I don't know. I don't. I think there's. I would like to know what Coach Izzo, what conversations Coach Izzo had with Travis Walton about the things that transpired in 2010. We would love to get an answer on that.
Obviously, you've seen this, but I'll point out that Travis Walton, after the Outside the Lines piece comes out, initially talks to you, which is interesting, and people can read his initial response to you in there, which is, I think I would characterize, I believe, accurately as he is surprised at your questions and your reporting. Subsequently, days later, comes out with a formal statement which denies essentially everything you guys reported, from never physically assaulting the woman who makes those allegations, claiming she threw a drink at him, claiming he has statements from independent witnesses to support his innocence. So he and saying he was never hired or fired by Michigan State. So he comes out with a on the record statement now contradicting your reporting. What is your reaction to Travis Walton's latest statement about the Outside the Lines report?
I mean, it's pretty much what he said to us when we talked to him earlier, although he did talk a little bit more about the reported sexual assault. But in terms of the incident in the bar, I mean, if you look at the police report, you'll see that there were two witnesses who backed up Ashley Thompson's story, Ashley Thompson being the young woman who said she was punched. And there was an interview with a bouncer who said that he came upon, when he heard the commotion, he came upon a group of people who were saying that she had been punched. We have her medical records showing that she went to the hospital after this. She was diagnosed with a concussion. Mm. And these statements that that he has, I haven't seen them. We did talk to the former prosecutor who worked for the city attorney's office at the time, and we had it in the original story that he said that Walton's attorney had given him statements that contradicted her account. I haven't seen these statements. I mean, if you read the police report, I'm not sure. I sort of leave it at that, right? I mean, she's got injuries. You've got people saying that this happened. You have the bouncer saying what they came across. And he's saying that nothing transpired. So, you know, and when I talked to him initially, I asked him, you know, did anything happen between you? Did she say anything to you? Did she provoke you? And he said no. And when he released the statement, I think he says she threw a drink at him.
Correct.
So, you know, I don't know. That's kind of where it stands. And then in terms of the reported sexual assault, so that was in the letter that we got a copy of, this internal letter from Michigan State, and it named Walton and two players who were on the team. And that the sexual assault counselor people were saying it was like secondhand information to her that this had happened. That's actually not true. Like, she's been in direct contact with the young woman who, you know, reported this. So, yeah, I mean, that's, and I would love to get more information on that. I mean, it's laid out there. We talked to another one of her, another former sexual assault counselor at Michigan State, who was also aware of this situation. You see this, look, I mean, there are two sides always come out on every story, and Travis Walton saying that this was consensual, that he had a relationship with her and that it was consensual, and this, you know, so, you know, maybe this will be further investigated.
Everything in the story is disturbing, but particularly disturbing in the piece is your reporting on Carolyn Shaner, who talks about how in, I believe it was 2010, she's alleging sexual assault against former Michigan State players Adrian Payne and Keith Appling. And again, I would say, go to Paula's Outside the Lines report, and you can see the details of that, including the video interviews obtained by OTL on Payne talking to detectives about this. One of the things, Paula, stopped me in my tracks was just a small line that you had in here that said, records show that both freshmen played in every regular season game that year. Appling told Outside the Lines that he did not remember if he and Payne received any sort of punishment from coaches. That just stood out to me as sort of indicative of these allegations about Michigan State not taking this stuff seriously or just keeping everything in-house so it doesn't get out. Can you talk about your reporting on that particular incident? Because I think if you read your piece that and believe the reporting, that is, in a nutshell, what this is about, this enabling of athletes and essentially Michigan State not doing its due diligence and not doing what it should be doing by the law when it comes to these these alleged victims.
Right. I mean, yeah, Carolyn, sure, I felt very disappointed by Michigan State, and not just you know, one thing I think it's important to note with her is that a lot of her complaint with Michigan State was how they handled her case. Outside of the decision, which she was obviously disappointed in, but she just always kind of got this impression from the people that she dealt with there, with the exception of her, you know, therapist, that they weren't really there to help her. When they moved the two players into a different housing arrangement, she says she wasn't told, and so she was on campus, like, you know, worrying about this. You know, what's happening, you know, there wasn't a lot of communication. And, you know, she, at the end, even up until, it's because the school ended up being required to go back and, you know, make sort of amends with her long after the fact. And so she was even meeting with them up until 2016, I think. And one of the things she says to us is that, like, they were just always very cold to her and, you know, didn't really make her feel as valued as they valued the two players. You know, the university ended up having someone investigate that case. Their investigation was then investigated, and there ended up not being an issue with overturning the decision, but the U.S. Department of Education said that part of the bigger issue here was that they waited so long to start an investigation. Mm. And, you know, I think people, the university, and I think I'm not going to speak on behalf of anyone with basketball program, but I think one of the things they would say is, well, you know, they were cleared by this university investigation back in 2010. So why should we have punished them? Why should we have held them out any games? And, you know, Carolyn Shaner obviously disagrees with that. I mean, she felt that was a real affront to her, that they didn't get any sort of punishment whatsoever for how she says she was treated.
There, you're going to get criticism, and you've seen it for sure, that ESPN is taking advantage of the Larry Nassar case and the publicity around it by publishing this story amid Nassar being sentenced, Michigan State's already in the news, and now, you know, and I'm sure this probably comes from a big group of Michigan State alums or supporters of the football and basketball program, that this is nothing more than ESPN trying to get page views and piling on. What when you see that, and I imagine you certainly see it on social media, what's your response to that?
Well, kind of going back to one of the things that we talked about earlier, which was there was a point last year when we were looking at what we knew we had on the basketball and football and athletic department issues and the Nassar, that we felt like there was a parallel because so much of this all speaks to the university's lack of transparency. I mean, I think that's one thing that you see from both of these. And there's actually some, even within the investigations, especially the investigation that the federal government did, the U.S. Department of Education of the university, like there even is some tie in there with some of the Nassar stuff and some of the stuff about the, you know, the rest of the school. And so we felt like it was fair to, you know, to pursue these at the same time, simply because there were some parallel issues. Now, that said, obviously the actual circumstances of the reported assaults are very, very different. I mean, you've got well over 100, 150, however many women we have with Nassar. This was an employee who was doing this. Very different, obviously now someone who's been convicted, very different circumstances in terms of the actual reports of the assault. But if you look at the university and some of its actions and its pushback and it's I was talking before about Carolyn Shaner, you know, what she felt, their attitude toward her as someone who had reported an assault was, there are some parallels there.
Paula, what is next in terms of reporting on Michigan State for both you and ESPN?
We'll continue to pursue both of these. We have someone right now at some of the Nassar hearings, and we'll continue to pursue that story. We'll continue to pursue this one. I mean, I'm hoping that we get some answers. We've had a lot of people call us after this story aired and said, you need to look into this, or I know this, and this has been happening. So I think, we'll continue our reporting in that way. And I also know that we'll follow the outside investigations, specifically the Attorney General's investigation.
Here are the two last topics I want to get to you on, and I appreciate your time today. It's pretty clear that there's, and I think the word is fair to use, crisis around the country when it comes to sexual assault in colleges. And I think you obviously sort of extend that further, and there's a crisis when it comes to sexual assaults involving athletes at colleges. It's not to stereotype that every athlete this is happening to, but we have seen these stories time and time again at major programs. You are somebody who has been in the middle of this for a long time now, more than a decade. From your end, how should we look at what is happening in terms of athletics and sexual assault and how athletic departments handle this on a national level?
I mean, every time we dive into one of these, and especially after Baylor, like when Mark Schlabaugh and I were into the weeds of it on Baylor, we kept thinking, and we even wrote about this in the book, that, this is a brand new day, right? Schools are getting the message. But these things keep happening, and they're happening everywhere. I mean, that's the one thing I would say. I mean, you brought it up. That was the one thing I would say to these Michigan State fans, is like, no, you're not the only school this happens at. It happens all over the place. I think the one area, I mean, obviously there needs to be continued work at prevention, right? I mean, that would be the ideal thing, that we stop having people report incidents of sexual assault, sexual violence, because they're not happening, right? That would be the greatest. But I think the one area where universities still need to improve and where they can probably make the fastest change is how they respond. And not just how they respond to the people who report the assaults and to the people who are accused, but to the student body and to the public in general. Because I think if there were more transparency, if there were more of an acknowledgement when these things happen, I think you would have fewer weeks like last week. I really do. I do. I mean, if people are more encouraged to speak out, to report, to be more transparent, one thing, going back to a reporting note, sort of schools are always like, oh, we can't say anything because of federal privacy laws. Okay, that's not entirely true. They have a lot more latitude to say things and to respond to questions than the law that they're citing prevents them from. And so... they do have the ability to say more. And I hope that we start seeing that.
Here's the last topic I want to get to. And obviously it's not, we're not going to be solving this one, Paul, in this little podcast here, but you, I think, are a great person to talk to. Because again, I'm not bullshitting you. I think you're one of the best sports investigative reporters in the country. And I think your work speaks to that. Without ESPN, to be blunt, I cannot imagine where sports investigative reporting would be in this country. Newspapers obviously are cutting staff left and right. Their profits have gone down. Many are not making money anymore. And one of the things that goes generally pretty early when it comes to outlets is investigative reporting, and certainly investigative reporting when it comes to sports. Not to say that places aren't doing it still. Thankfully, they are. But I've even seen this at Sports Illustrated. We just have less investigative or people with investigative reporter backgrounds than we certainly did in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s. When you look around the country, what do you, and again, I realize it's kind of a big question, but are you still hopeful that what you do is going to exist on a local level? Or do you believe that the only place we may get this is at a national level, which means local stories are going to fall by the wayside because there's just not staffing to do it?
Oh, God. It just makes me sad. I came from newspapers. I worked all over the country at newspapers. And, even back 10 years ago, when the resources were scarce. I mean, it would have been, I can't imagine in newspapers launching the legal fight that we did. We just wouldn't have had the money to do it.
Right.
The budget wouldn't have been there. And that's sad. There's the one thing that's encouraging that you see some of these nonprofit groups starting up, focusing in investigative journalism, Reveal, ProPublica, others like that, Center for Investigative Reporting. But you don't see a lot of sports investigations in those groups. I guess you're right. I mean, there's not a lot. I am thankful every single day that we have the resources here to do what we can do, especially when you talk about cases that end up in litigation. And, I wish I could say that there's some great rosy future for local investigative journalism. I hope there is. I hope that I hope people really start to value. I mean, this is tough in this climate, right? I hope people start to value the media as a watchdog again.
Right.
I think that's lost. And if there's anything that this industry needs to get back, it's that. It's that. That the media are an advocate for accountability and transparency. And if there's anything anything that can be pushed on a local and national level, I think it's that.
It's well said. ESPN deserves criticism when it does stuff that when criticism is warranted. That said, I think if you're a sports fan, or certainly if you're somebody who cares about the sports journalism, you have to appreciate the resources that you guys have put into investigative journalism. And you hit it on the head. The resources that you put into fighting some of these cases where they are suing you in your attempts to get public documents, and you hit it on the head. Without having lawyers on staff or without having the resources, legal resources to fight that, a lot of times places can, Paul, they can play the long game and they can eventually just beat you in court. Because you're just going to give up because you can't afford the money to keep fighting for what the information you want is. So I appreciate what you guys do, at least in the investigative and outside the lines division, because I know you've spent, the public doesn't know you end up spending a lot of money and you don't necessarily make that money back in any kind of profit. You're just sort of doing it for the public good. And I'm glad you guys fought MSU. I mean, this stuff has to get out. It's a matter of, in my opinion, public importance. Paula Levine is, did I screw that up or no?
No, you got it right.
All right, here we go. Paula Levine is an investigative reporter at ESPN. You can find her work on Outside the Lines, ESPN.com. You'll see her on SportsCenter. In addition to her ESPN work, she is the co-author with Mark Schlabaugh of Violated, Exposing Rape at Baylor University, Amid College Football Sexual Assault Crisis. There are more famous people at ESPN for sure, but Paula is one of the invaluable people that makes ESPN what it is when ESPN is at its best. Paula, I really appreciate you joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, before we get to Peter King, my colleague who is upcoming on this podcast, let me tell my listeners about Mattress Firm. Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm, except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have literally and figuratively covered you up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Paul Levine, and we make a 180-degree turn and bring in my colleague Peter King, who is in Minneapolis covering the Super Bowl. He, of course, has the MMQB podcast. Check that out on Apple Podcast, Stitcher. Where else could that be on? Google Play, and wherever else you can find that fine podcast. And we're going to do 10, 15 minutes on Peter's podcast. You know, Peter's on a million different things, so you can get his football information anywhere. But in terms of sort of a media play, I'm not sure he's really talked about his podcast so much. And Peter King, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Hey, thanks a million, Richard. Great to be on with you.
You got it. Peter, so formal. We know each other forever. You feel like a formal guest there. Your last podcast, you had Al Michaels. Before that, the Eagles coach, Doug Peterson, Kyle Rudolph, the Minnesota tight end prior to that. And then if you go down your list, Peter, I mean, you've had major names on this podcast. Tom Brady, who probably does not do this often, did a two-part podcast with you. You had Kirk Cousins. I know Matt Ryan's been on this podcast. Tony Romo, John Elway. When it comes to booking the NFL, have you found it to be easy because of all your years of experience in the league, or can booking even for you be a challenge when it comes to getting a podcast guest and that guest committing to 30 minutes to an hour?
A challenge would be putting it mildly. Richard, I mean, when I started this in the summer of 2016, it was a little bit easier than it is now. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, I was telling a lot of people, hey, I'm just starting this podcast. I want to have great guests. I want to do it right. So, you know, it was fairly, I wouldn't say easy, but, you know, it was a thing when we first started it, sort of the exclusivity of it and the fact that, at least at the beginning, I tried to do every one of these in person. Hmm. And so, you know, one day I'd been really wanted to do Ben Roethlisberger, and I pressed and pressed, and one week they said, hey, Ben will do it. So I actually flew to Pittsburgh, got on a plane, went to do Roethlisberger, and then just came home. And you know, I've done that a few times. I did it with Luke Kuechly in Carolina in 2016, but I've probably done more of them on the phone this year. I did Al Michaels on the phone Saturday before I left for the Super Bowl because I think he thought it would be crazy to try to do it out here. And I want to make it convenient for the person who I'm doing it with. Probably of all of them so far, you know, the unique one I would say would be Tom Brady, because, you know, the Tom Brady podcast basically started out as me visiting Tom Brady in Montana 1 week after the Super Bowl, and I was simply going to write it as a Monday morning quarterback column. But before I went there, I just thought to myself, you know, I'm really going to try to get him to record this. And the way I did this is a little bit of the way that I think Gotham Chopra went after him for the Tom versus Time documentary, you know, on Facebook Watch. I talked to Gotham about this, and I felt like I was talking to somebody who kind of had stolen my game plan a little bit. But when I arrived in Montana, I said to Brady, hey, I brought my podcast equipment, and I'm wondering if you would mind recording this. And I would not only write this, but we would do it as a podcast. And the way I kind of sold it was, listen, you're going to want a record of this. I'm going to go over with a fine-tooth comb what happened in the second half of the greatest comeback in NFL history, play by play by play. I want to know exactly what happened. We ended up doing that for probably about 40 minutes. But anyway, I said to him, you know, someday, you know, your son is going to say, Dad, what happened in that Super Bowl? And I said, now here we are. We're 1 week after the game. Your memory will never be clearer about what happened that day. Would you record it? He said, sure. I mean, I had this sort of big speech made up. He just shrugged his shoulders and said, sure, I'm fine with that. So he sat in a chair, held my mic, and we talked for, I think, 76 minutes and made it into a two-part podcast. And those are the things that excite me about doing this and excite me about having a podcast, because you don't normally get to have, in a lot of these instances, the kind of conversations I've gotten to have with a lot of these people. And the Brady one, just to say one other thing about it, I think that, you know, when I finished that, the thing that I liked about it the most is you're hearing non-press conference Tom for maybe the first time since you ever heard him. You know, Jason Garrett, the Cowboys coach, came up to me at the NFL meetings last year, and he said, hey, I mean, just unprompted, he said, hey, I just wanted to say I love that podcast you did with Brady. I loved it so much that I had all of my coaches, I told all my coaches, this is an assignment. I want, you know, you guys got to go listen to this podcast. So they all did. And he wanted them to hear about excellence and about not settling and all that stuff. And I think that's one of the things that I've been able to do in some of these conversations, and some you don't have enough time. Doug Peterson last week after the NFC Championship game, standing outside his office in the mayhem of the locker room, I'm not going to get, you know, 40 minutes with him. I'm going to get whatever, 12 or whatever it was. I don't remember. But you just try to do as much as you can to try to illuminate the game that I cover.
Peter, do you know if that is Tom Brady's first ever podcast? Did he happen to say to you whether he had done that forum before or medium before?
I don't know. Hmm. I don't know whether he has or not.
Just because I don't
recall him ever doing anything like that.
Yeah, I can't recall him on an audio form going that long. One of the, you know, I find on this podcast that guests are less guarded because of the intimacy of the medium. When you are interviewing a Brady or Kyle Rudolph or, you know, or any of the coaches or players that you have interviewed since 2016 in podcast form, do you find they're different than, let's say, if you were sitting with them in front of their locker or if you were sitting with them at their house or in a hotel room where, again, it would just be you guys one-on-one, but the medium would be different because you'd be face-to-face and maybe you have a recorder there?
I think you're right, Richard. I think that's a salient point you're making, that in my opinion, one of the great things about the podcast genre is you get to talk to people about things that oftentimes they really want to talk about and they really want to get into in depth. And I thought one of the coolest ones, and not that it was, I wouldn't say, you know, there was anything in there said that was particularly memorable, but Dan Quinn of the Atlanta Falcons, I recorded him last year at the NFL meetings in Phoenix, and I talked to him for about 20 minutes about his father, and we ran it as a Father's Day podcast. And I said to myself, I'm going to do that again this year. I may even do a Mother's Day podcast. I don't know. But I know I'm going to do the Father's Day podcast again, in part because Dan Quinn was very emotional about his dad. Hmm. And I don't think anybody's ever asked him about not necessarily his relationship with his father, but the importance of his father to getting him to this point in his life. And so I do think that there are a lot of times when we can sit down and we can talk to guys, and they're going to be able to talk about subjects that oftentimes they don't get a chance to talk about. Another one of my favorite periods in a podcast, Bruce Arians was one of my first podcasts, early 2016. And I will never forget, we talked about Bear Bryant, because he was on Bear Bryant's last coaching staff at Alabama. And he was so incredibly good about what he took from Bear Bryant. And one of the points he made was the thing he has always remembered about Bryant, and he's kept it to this day. He said, this is how I have coached the Arizona Cardinals. Coach them hard, hug them later. And so there's these little things that, like, I've had 50 conversations in my life with Bruce Arians, and the best thing he's ever said to me, by far, is the thing he takes with Bear Bryant with him to this day. Now, he's out of coaching, but every day when he coaches his team, he takes the Bear Bryant ethos, and he said that on our podcast. So those are the kind of things you get into some things. I mean, the Al Michaels podcast this week was funny because I talked to him about I talked to him about O.J. Simpson and about the time that he was on the ABC News with Peter Jennings. And there was in his words, a farcical phone caller.
Right. Very famous Howard Stern prank call.
He went on the Howard Stern show and basically talked about how Peter Jennings on the nightly news during the white Ford Bronco chase got prank phone called by a Howard Stern caller. and so I don't know why that occurred to me, but I just remember over the years hearing that three or four times. But I've never heard Al's explanation of what exactly happened. So for all those who listen to the podcast this week and they hear Al Michaels talking about the farcical phone caller, a totally farcical phone call, I don't know that if I were ever in a scenario with him at NBC, it would come up and say, "Hey, Al, what about the totally farcical phone call with Peter Jennings?" But that's the great thing about our podcast. You probably are the same way. I asked Dan Shaughnessy on the podcast this week, the columnist for the Boston Globe, do you think there's any chance that David Price picked up the phone this offseason, called Dennis Eckersley and said, "I'm sorry"? Now, I don't know how many people know about this, but Price sort of ridiculed and was angry about what he thought was Dennis Eckersley being too tough on a Nesson telecast, and it was really a huge story in Boston, and Shaughnessy being Shaughnessy killed David Price throughout the season for what a ridiculous controversy he invented because of it.
Yeah, but the Al Michaels story, that prank call is famous, and I don't know if Al said this to you, but I know he said in the past that he used the word lest in his conversation.
Yeah, he used the word less than farcical in a sentence for the first time
right,
in his life.
That's what's great about it. He said he's never used the word less again in broadcasting, which is phenomenal.
That's good.
I'll have to check that out on your podcast this week. All right, two more here, Peter, before we let you get back to the festivities there in Minneapolis. Do you listen to other football podcasts, whether it's not even a Q&A, whether it's analytics or something else? But is there are football podcasts part of your listening diet?
I listen to Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling all the time, and I really like it. I love listening to Andy Benoit talk about football. I really should tweet that out a little bit more because I have so much respect for him. And I think Gary Gramling is an incredibly underrated person to listen to about football. And I listen occasionally. I need to listen more, but I listen occasionally to the guys at Pro Football Focus. Because I think they really, really are smart. Not only listening to some of their podcasts, but listen when they are guests on other people's podcasts. And I had Steve Palazzolo on my podcast from Pro Football Focus one day. And I love really, really intelligent football conversation. And Richard, you know what I do a lot of times? I download a lot of podcasts. And so, like, if I am, you know, like, if I'm driving somewhere, say I'm on the train one day, it was a couple of weeks ago, last Thursday when I drove down to Philly, I was going to be drive to work the next day with Doug Peterson. What I do a lot of times is I will call a podcast up and listen to it. And I love the medium. I absolutely love the medium because you get to hear what you want when you want it. And now, you know, whether it's Crime Town or whether some of those other podcasts, a lot of times if I'm either on a long drive or something like that, I can listen to several episodes at once. And I just think it's so much fun. I listen to more podcasts than I watch television.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah, I really enjoy them a lot. A lot of times I'll be working, you know, on a Saturday, and maybe I'll just have a podcast on. I love This American Life. I really, really like The Moth, and I either listen into that, the stories, I either listen to that live on WNYC in New York, or, you know, I'll go and I'll listen to it online. So I love podcasts. I think the medium is really, really fun.
Yeah, same here. And just to give the promo, it's the MMQB 10 Things podcast with co-host Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling, and it's excellent. Those guys are really good. They're smart.
Yeah, they're so smart.
When it comes to football, so check that out. All right, Peter, finally, you know, you go through your list of the people you've had on, and, you know, you've obviously had a lot of big-name people in the NFL. I mean, if you're getting Tom Brady for a two-part podcast, you sort of really can't get any higher. But is there anyone in the league or connected to the NFL that you have tried to get and that you have not been able to get, or that you have at this point not reached out to but will reach out to, and it's somebody you really want?
Richard, that's a great question. And the answer is a slightly complicated, because, like, I would really like to get a long podcast. Like, I've had Carson Wentz, for instance. I did a live podcast after the Philadelphia-Washington Monday night game, and I had Wentz on for maybe 14 minutes, but it was so much game-related. And Carson Wentz doesn't do a lot of media. But and I don't just mean Carson Wentz. It could also apply to Deshaun Watson. It could apply to Ezekiel Elliott, Dak Prescott. Here's the way I sort of look at my job, my role, okay? I want to introduce people who love football to everybody who is big and important in the NFL. And so, okay, yeah, I've had Roger Goodell on my podcast. I've had Jerry Jones for longer than an hour on my podcast. I've had, you know, so I've had people through the length and breadth of the NFL. But I feel like now, going forward, I want to make sure that I sort of honor the new generation of really big players and really big people in the game. And instead of just doing podcasts with them that, for instance, are very much game related and might only be like 12 to 17 minutes long, like, I really want to sit down at some point with Ezekiel Elliott, with Deshaun Watson, with the guys who are next. Because I almost feel this way, Richard. You know, like, a lot of the people I've had on my podcast are the established, you know, long-term Peyton Manning, Tom Brady. I mean, I want to make sure that I'm not in aligning with people of a certain age. And look, I'm 60. They're not 60, but I want to make sure that I introduce people who listen to my podcast to the new stars, to the next generation. I've already determined that this year in the off season, one of the things I'm going to do is reach out to teams and to players and to agents, like I've just said, and say, listen, I want a half hour at some point, any point, with some of these people. And then we'll see what happens. So if you ask me who haven't I gotten that I really would like to get, I can't really name anybody because most of the time I've been able to get, nobody really sticks out I haven't been able to get, but I want to get the new stars to hopefully get the new generation hooked and to have them listening, not just to my podcast, but to all of the podcasts in our network. And so that's sort of what I'd like to do next this off season and in the 2018 season.
The podcast is the MMQB podcast with Peter King. Like I said, you can get that on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher. Last interview was with Al Michaels. One before that, Eagles coach Doug Peterson. Check it out if you're a football fan. To me, it's an absolute must. Peter, I'm glad we did this because I wanted to just find something for a quick, like, 15 minutes that maybe you hadn't talked about a lot. So I appreciate your thinking on
this. It was fun because I never get a chance to talk about this. I wish I did do it a little bit more, and because I just love the genre. I know you do too.
Yep.
And I think you and I sort of feel the same way about podcasting in general.
We do.
That it's one of the things that we both want to be really good at because we want to make sure that we are servicing everybody who loves, you know, like, for instance, you know, the media and the radio TV aspect of the media, which is what you do so well. And I want to make sure that everybody gets served, not just what is the biggest thing in football, but in sort of different things as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. Thank you.
You got it, Peter. If you do more ice fishing in Minneapolis, good luck to you. I saw the photos. Looks good.
It was a little nippy out there. It was only 10 below zero wind chill. But I did catch, for my 3 hours of trouble out there, Richard, I did catch an 8-ounce sunfish.
Wow. Congrats to you. That sounds pretty impressive.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Not a lot of sunfish in Brooklyn, but we appreciate the story nonetheless. Peter King, I'll see you around the office. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Paula Levine for her insights in sports investigative reporting, and my colleague, longtime colleague, Peter King, to talk a little bit about podcasting and his sort of how he approaches his podcast. And the Brady stuff's just interesting because, again, Tom Brady, it would be great to know this for a fact. I can't think of Tom Brady having done a 76-minute podcast anywhere else. It just seems like I would have read that somewhere. So I apologize if you are the person who has done a 70-minute podcast with Tom Brady, but that just seems pretty unique. And Peter did that in February of 2017, if you want to go back in his archives and check that out. My producer is Lou Pellegrino. As always, my thanks to Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated. Previous Sports Illustrated Media podcasts include multiple roundtables. The last one was with Chad Finn, Jimmy Trina, and AJ Perez. And then in terms of the solo guests, we had Fred Gadelli, Andrew Reskoff, the director and producer of the Super Bowl, Jim Nantz, who we talked to for, I think, 80-plus minutes. He was really, really interesting just on his career. Katie Nolan, Jamel Hill, and Mike Francesa. Check all those out at the Sports Illustrated Media podcast. If you like this stuff, please give us a review and a rating. It has impact. One, it moves you up the iTunes charts, and two, the bosses take notice. So again, for everybody at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.